wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this July 9th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Well, this morning on the Old Mole, we'll have Bill Resnick talking with organizer Joanna Misnick on electoral politics and what is to be done. Joanna Misnick is a longtime organizer, activist, and writer, and a good comrade of the Old Mole. And, well, Fran Michel's going to talk about the dirty deeds that are happening with the Supreme Court, in particular the ruling on crisis pregnancy centers. And from the June 2018, just recently, Portland Democratic Socialists of America had a day school, a summer day school. And Katie Barrett talked about climate change, system change, and the need for a planned economy. We will hear a portion of that talk. Katie Barrett is a member of Portland Rising Tide and has been involved in the fight against expanding fossil fuel infrastructure for the past 4 years. And we'll conclude today's show with book mole Larry Bolden, who reviews Elizabeth Cohen's The Glitch. It's a quirky, insightful novel about high-powered women and the future role of artificial intelligence devices. But now we'll start with Bill Resnick and Joanna Misnick.
Thanks, Denise. Joanna Misnick, welcome to KBOO.
Well, thanks for having me. Good morning, everybody.
Joanna Misnick is a seasoned leftist, always a revolutionary in the sense of working to replace capitalist arrangements with a more humane and democratic system. And with those values, she was always what was called a third-camp person, critical of both capitalism and Russian communism, struggling to replace them with genuine democracy, which is now known as that better possible, necessary, democratic, and sustainable world. Through her years, these were in Chicago, she's been a union activist, a movement organizer, with leadership positions in various groups. She's continuously grappled in writing and debate as to left strategy from the 60s to today. She's now a member and activist leader in the organization Solidarity and the Democratic Socialists of America. So, Joanna, last week, a young woman of color, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, dynamic, likable, terrific down-to-earth personality, but thoughtful, too, very able to articulate policy. She identified herself as a proud member of the Democratic Socialists of America and supporter of Bernie Sanders. To the surprise of everyone, including herself, she won the Democratic primary for Congress in Queens, a borough of New York City. She defeated a 10-term congressman, a leader of the Democratic Party, one of the major contenders to replace Nancy Pelosi as leader of the House of Representatives, the Democrats. This shocked the Democratic Party establishment and led to a tremendous surge of interest in an electoral group from the left in this country. It was a repeat of the Sanders campaign, but in some ways even more inspirational. Joanna, let's talk about her campaign, what she stood for, and then we can discuss electoral politics in general and running in elections, the problems and pitfalls, but also how it can be really important. So, Joanna, start with the Ocasio-Cortez program
campaign.
Yeah.
Well, the campaigners say they were out on the streets for almost a year, and at the end they had 1,000 folks knocking on 10, 15, 20,000 or more doors in the ward. It was an aggressive campaign that was without much money, and it mirrored and expanded on the Bernie Sanders phenomenon. Bernie Sanders left in his wake a certain set of demands that represent humane values in our country, which apparently there's still a tremendous amount of support for those values and those demands if you go out and talk to people in an election campaign in particular. So she was for Medicare for all. She was for free education. She was for prison reform, and she was for abolishing ICE, which Bernie was not for, and even in the last week of her campaign, went over to the border to be a part of this opposition to separating children from their parents. And, of course, liberating funds to better the lives of the people in her district and holding on and establishing rent control and rights for tenants, which are restricted by state law and many state laws in the United States. So she was a democratic socialist with a social democratic program. The other thing about her,
including taxing the rich, was my sense.
Yes, of course, money to be gained by taxing the rich. But she is also a very talented individual as a campaigner, and that counts in a race. When someone has the ability to be quick on their feet and to answer questions, and her performance on The Late Show was symbolic of that, where she defined socialism and the whole place burst into applause, as it's a situation where in a society like ours, no one should want for anything. No one should be poor and hungry. And people just went crazy. It was touching those values again that I think are coming to the fore in the rebellion of the states. Now, she was not a product of the DSA as a candidate. She was picked out by something called the Justice Democrats, who are Democrats, pure progressive Democrats, who wield a great deal of money and foot power in elections that they choose to join in on, and they chose her as a candidate, as did Our Revolution, which is Bernie's operation for progressive candidates in the United States, headed by Nina Turner. So those who lined up to run, and she went to the DSA for endorsement and ended up joining the DSA. So she is something of a new person to the new socialist movement in the United States.
One of the things about her campaign, like Bernie's, and they do this, and it's, of course, right. She reiterated, it's not me. I'm no
yes.
savior. I was just a bartender, where she was probably, where she really did learn how to deal with people in a
right.
modest, brash, but, you know, sort of authoritative and interesting and fun ways. I would love to have gone to that bar. In any event, she's a very successful personality, but she would
right.
say, I'm no savior, I'm just an ordinary person. We need movements, as Bernie would say constantly.
That's right.
On the campaign trail. When he came to Portland, he was very good at exciting people, and he said that, you know, that was his thing. The problem,
now,
on the other hand,
she has said from time to time that we have to reclaim. There's a variety of opinion in the DSA and a variety of positions. In her case, as someone brand new, she sometimes would say, we have to take our party back. In other words, turn the Democratic Party into an instrument that we can use instead of the corporations. That's one position in the DSA. Other folks who are running, including Julia Salazar, who is this other a real DSA candidate, someone who was in the DSA for several years, running for state Senate in New York, she very definitively says we cannot reform the Democratic Party. What we're doing here is running to build a base for socialist ideas that can build another working class party in the United States. So there are strategic differences among the candidates. There's a variety of candidate strategy itself.
At this point, though, it seems to me that there's general agreement. We have to build our forces. We have to build something.
Yeah.
They may have an inside-outside perspective, but the outside is really still more important, in fact, in many ways than the inside. They recognize that it would take a powerful force to challenge the powers that be
yes.
in the Democratic Party and in the nation, even though they're showing signs of cracking apart themselves.
We shall help.
Yeah, let's talk about the pitfalls. Let me just do a reintroduction. This is Joanna Misnick. She's a long time and still really active organizer, activist, writer, debater, personality in Chicago. Maybe we should talk about Harold Washington a little bit later, Joanna, when he won office. Let's talk about the pitfalls of winning office. And there are like two of them. You should go, let's go through them fairly quickly. But one of them is you run to win, so you sort of dilute
right.
yourself to nothing often. And secondly, when you do win, then you really run into trouble
right
now. So talk about both of them.
Yeah, you do dilute yourself when you win, but what's characteristic of a number of these DSA candidates is they have a standard program that, again, mirrors and expands Bernie's program, and they run on it. So they don't dilute themselves to the same degree that someone who's just out there trying to become a professional politician would do. Parenthetically, we don't have a system yet in the DSA for accountability. We are out there for the first time trying to elect certain of our members to various offices, but we don't have an idea what's going to happen concretely when we try to hold their feet to the fire. Because there's where the problem comes in, the pressure, the absolute pressure, and it includes to get reelected, so you have to bring home the bacon for your ward or for your district. And the amount of pressure that's going to be put on these folks is pretty enormous. You can see it happening to Bernie now with the silences that he's a lot more cautious than I would like him to be on certain issues. He's still good on Medicare, but he's still dodging bullets from the Democratic Party leadership, and he's pulling some of his planks, putting them to bed for a minute. So there's that. There's a big problem of when you get elected. And there's a problem from our point of view as the DSA, as we're brand new, and we often think that we have not got as much power as we think we do. We need a professionalization of the organization. We need training. We need people who can actually keep the base that might have been developed in the given district alive and well. And we've learned that in Chicago through previous elections, where we've had an independent force called the United Working Families, a coalition of unions and community groups who have won certain districts or who have made a big impact in certain aldermanic races, who leave things behind, leave an independent political organization behind after the election. And some of these are viable enough that come the next city election, they're going to play a big role in who gets elected to the city council. That's what DSA has to learn. We have no track record on that, really.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more on the pitfalls. One of them is when you run to win and you get so excited by that possibility and then you reach out for votes and don't want to offend people and you've got 1,000 volunteers, what you do is miseducate them instead of them going and talking to people about the real issues and themselves learning through all of that conversation with one another and the people. They do this sort of least common denominator pablum talk. What they learn is you really can't talk to people honestly, nor do they learn how to talk to people honestly because they're sort of trained in pablum. It's really insidious, this run to win, at least as I see it and as I saw it in campaigns in the past. The other thing, talk about Harold Washington. When you do win, and you went on a really radical program, and it happened in the United States in lots of areas, and Harold Washington in particular in Chicago, and Mitterrand in France, and Harold Wilson in England. They won state power. They had power, they thought. And then what happened?
Well, what happened is the capitalist economy had its demands. In Mitterrand's case, for 1 year, he was nationalizing everything. And then
the banks,
the economy busted and the capitalist class took over and said, this is what you have to do. Release those nationalizations and begin what was essentially a process of neoliberalization of the French society, the very beginning.
And the left decomposed,
too. And by the way, throw out the Communist Party,
The left decomposed, too. I mean, they had this power for a while, and then they just were bathed in disappointment, and they saw what happened, and you wound up without a left in these countries because they took power without having power. And Harold Washington, too, was a terrible story. Tell a little bit about Chicago.
Well, I wasn't in Chicago at that time.
Oh, I thought that was...
I haven't. I've come here right after Harold Washington. So maybe you should.
Oh, you were in the Obama period.
Yeah.
In Illinois.
Yes, I visited his... I saw his home. It's going to become a museum. Okay.
All right. Well, good for you. You're a good citizen.
Yes.
Yes. But electoral politics, there's all sorts of things that should be done, that have to be done, and that can be done in electoral politics. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Joanna Misnick, a longtime organizer, a third camper, campaigned both against capitalist arrangements as well as the arrangements of state capitalism in the Soviet Union. Joanna, let's talk about electoral politics. There's a lot that can be done. And maybe we will do it this time.
anecdotally, I've been in the revolutionary left for 50-some years, and you get used to a certain size of your organization. There's like 8 or 10 people at your branch meeting, or 30 people. I go out in the streets of Chicago today, I bump into my co-members of the DSA just by walking around and finding out that someone's in the DSA. I just checked out of the grocery store and the fellow was in the DSA. The size of this phenomenon has to be taken into account. It's brand new. These are people who didn't live through 68, don't have a connector to the issues of the 20th century as much as we had, or the legacy. And the 20th century left came across the bridge very thin. It doesn't have a whole lot of folks and a whole lot of credibility on the ground to help this phenomenon. So we have to be, I think, patient. But I do think that a number of these folks in the DSA are radicalizing very quickly. They are considering things like Ralph Miliband, you know, like Andre Gortz, the issue of anti-capitalist structural reform or revolutionary reform. Can you take social democracy and turn it left and turn it into an anti-capitalist pro-revolutionary instrument?
Yeah, and build institutions as well
that,
in fact, demonstrate those possibilities, like in healthcare, like around the environment, like in energy. Joanna, we sort of ran out of time, but you get the last word. No, take a last word. 30 seconds.
What's the last word? I think everybody should join the DSA and help build the new socialist movement in the United States.
And keep one foot in a revolutionary organization.
Absolutely.
The way you do. Thanks a lot for talking to us, Joanna.
Okay. Thank you.
Right.
Bye-bye.
So long.
That is Rise Above, originally Black Flag, but that's a cover version of a really great song. Thanks to Joanna Misnick for a wonderful visit on the Old Mole. We'll have more from Portland DSA later in the program. There was a summer day school last month, and Katie Barrett was there to present on climate change, system change, and the need for a planned economy. We're going to hear a portion of her talk. And we'll also have our book mole, Larry Bolden, reviewing Elizabeth Cohen's The Glitch. But next up, as you may have heard, the U.S. Supreme Court is up to dirty tricks, and Fran Michel is here to tell us more about recent decisions.
As the Communist Manifesto observes, the executive of the modern state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie. But there have been times when the pressure of left organizing and conflicts within the ruling class have created opportunities for the state or its branches to intervene on the side of the people. In the past, for instance, laws have provided, and the Supreme Court has affirmed, the right to equal education and accommodation, to voting rights, to access to contraception and to abortion care. At present, of course, things are different. If we ask, as a recent piece in Truth Out did, whose agenda is the Supreme Court carrying out? It's not too difficult to answer: the corporate class and white supremacists, as well as sexists. In recent decisions, the court has upheld Trump's Muslim ban, taken away fair share fees from public sector unions, and ruled that crisis pregnancy centers can lie to people. It's the last of these decisions I want to give more attention to today. It reflects long-standing organizing by the patriarchal religious right, and is also influenced by racism and a gift to capital power. The case is the National Institute of Family and Life Advocates, NIFLA, versus Becerra, the Attorney General of California. NIFLA is an anti-abortion legal group that provides legal services and advocacy for what is known as crisis pregnancy centers. Anti-abortion counseling centers that usually present themselves deceptively as fake healthcare clinics. Their goal is to intervene with those who might be considering terminating a pregnancy and to persuade them instead to give birth. In pursuing that goal, investigations have shown that CPCs will usually not only advertise themselves deceptively, but often provide misinformation, anti-choice propaganda, and shaming and intimidation. The religious right typically believes that sex for pleasure without procreation is wrong. They fear the possibility of losing the private, caring labor that mothers and other women have historically provided, because they see no larger framework for communal care and social provisioning. Right-wing groups in Oregon are hoping to put on the November ballot a measure to amend the state constitution to ban using public funds for health insurance that covers abortion. Typically, CPCs offer free pregnancy testing, the sort of thing you could find yourself at a pharmacy, and sometimes they offer ultrasounds, especially in states where an ultrasound is now required before an abortion. But they also frequently lie about the dangers of abortion, suggesting it will lead to cancer, sterility, mental illness, none of which is true. In fact, abortion is far safer than carrying a pregnancy to term, since childbirth is 14 times more likely than abortion to result in the pregnant person's death in the United States. These fake clinics may lie about the gestational age of a fetus or the likelihood of miscarriage or the laws on reproductive care, all in an effort to delay action until it's too late for a pregnancy to be terminated. They may lie about the possibility that the birth of a child will change an abusive partner into one who's not abusive. They may lie about the effectiveness of contraception in protecting against pregnancy or sexually transmitted diseases. Such lies can, of course, be dangerous to health, with delays in qualified prenatal care potentially causing lifelong health problems for infants. Moreover, fake clinics are often targeted at low-income women and women of color, who are at greater risk of maternal mortality and morbidity when they do give birth. And these centers are 5 times more numerous than are the clinics that actually provide abortions. But fake clinics have had support from lawmakers, who in some states have provided public funding for them or have mandated that they be included among the referrals provided to those who are pregnant. In response, a number of jurisdictions have passed laws that prevent misleading advertising and require CPCs to disclose the limited nature of the services they actually provide. California's 2015 Reproductive Freedom, Accountability, Comprehensive Care, and Transparency Act, FACT Act, required unlicensed centers to post notice of their unlicensed status and required licensed centers to post visible notices about where to find free or low-cost abortion, contraception, and prenatal care available through public programs. NIFLA challenged the act on the grounds that it violated the right to free speech in some way that is not true of so-called informed consent laws, which were upheld in the 1992 Casey decision. Clarence Thomas's argument for the Supreme Court's majority decision suggests that it's okay to allow the fake clinics to lie because they aren't really providing medical services. But as Justice Breyer notes in his dissent, if a state can lawfully require a doctor to tell a woman seeking an abortion about adoption services, why should it not be able, as here, to require a medical counselor to tell a woman seeking prenatal care or other reproductive health care about childbirth and abortion services? Breyer's opinion dissects in legal detail the many problems with the majority opinion. Aside from the problems a layperson might notice, Breyer also points out that the grounding Thomas provides for the majority opinion not only ignores information provided to the court, draws on less than relevant case law while ignoring more relevant precedent, and rests on distinctions that lack moral, practical, and legal force. The majority's approach also, Breyer notes, in suggesting that heightened scrutiny applies to much economic and social legislation, places ordinary disclosure laws and much security law or consumer protection law at constitutional risk, and at the least threatens considerable litigation over the constitutional validity of much, perhaps most, government regulation. That is, like Citizens United and debates on college campuses, this decision is part of the right-wing project of weaponizing the notion of free speech against the interests of the vulnerable majority. The decision not only makes it legal for fake clinics to lie to their clients, it also sets up a ruling that may lead to challenge and overruling of other laws that require companies to provide customers with adequate and truthful information. In short, and not surprisingly at this point, although California may and should come back with a rewritten FACT Act, we can't rely only on the legal system to address the problem of fake clinics and women's needs for reproductive care. Fortunately, there are informational and activist resources available online. The site exposefakeclinics.com has a wealth of resources, including a database of fake clinics organized by state, and the listing includes some in Portland and the surrounding area. The activists who made the site proposed providing Yelp reviews for local fake clinics, thus alerting Yelp users to the real scoop. The site reproaction.org has more suggestions about what to do about fake clinics in your area. They offer a webinar and a direct action toolkit for organizing protests at fake clinics, speakouts and teach-ins involving those who've been victimized by these groups, petitions for investigation into the use of public funds, and getting the word out through letters to the editor or op-eds. For the Old Mall Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michelle sharing the information and inviting you to do so as well.
Thank you, Fran Michelle, as always. Well, this morning our guest, Joanna Misnick, talked about the need for left education and training. And on June 24th, Portland DSA did just that, organizing a summer day school at the Southeast Sunnyside Community Center. I was fortunate enough to have that day off, and I spent the entire day there. It was a very well-attended and, I will say, very successful event, and I want to congratulate the organizers for that. One of the participants, Katie Barrett, presented on climate change. Her talk was Climate Change, System Change, and the Need for a Planned Economy. And we're going to hear a portion of that this morning. Let me tell you a little bit about Katie, who is a member of Portland Rising Tide and a direct action organizer and trainer, and has been involved in the fight against expanding fossil fuel infrastructure for the past 4 years. Most recently, her work has been focused on educating people about the dangers of carbon pricing and market-based false solutions to climate crisis. We are going to pick up her talk at the point in which she begins to use some examples to educate about the shenanigans that go along with some of the market-based solutions, and then move into the alternative economic systems, including what is called just transition. We thank Katie for allowing us to use this information, and we'll go from there.
I want to look at one example of how market-based solutions like catch and trade are working out, because they've been in place for quite a few years now, and we have plenty of evidence to show that, just as we suspected, they're not doing so great. Now, what you hear is that renewable energy has doubled, but it went from 3% to a whopping 6%. Not exactly the huge transition that we need to see if we're going to switch to all renewables. Instead, what we see is a huge increase in the use of natural gas. Now, this natural gas is largely coming from fracking. The fracking boom has been a wild success for industry, partly because we've allowed industry to count natural gas as a cleaner fuel. It produces less CO2 when you burn it. So if you look at the results from this program, you do actually see reductions in CO2 emissions. But the problem is CO2 is not the only greenhouse gas. And the big problem with gas in particular is methane. The fracking process produces a lot of methane in the system. So while you burn it at the source and produce CO2 and produce less of it, you're introducing more methane, and that's not counted in these systems. But it's a big problem because methane is 82 times more potent than CO2. 82 times. In the short term, if we release more methane, we are likely to cook ourselves. And it just so happens that scientists a couple years ago started to notice a huge spike in methane, and they weren't sure where it was coming from. They suspected the U.S. because of the fracking boom. And lo and behold, studies were done to show that, yes, all of this fracking that we are now doing in the name of cleaner burning fuels is actually releasing massive amounts of methane into the atmosphere. And real quick, I just want to explain this. Because this is where our climate policy is. This is the only kind of climate policy that is on the table at the moment. Our cap and trade, cap and invest, carbon taxes, and the fee and dividend model, which is being promoted by a group called Citizens Climate Lobby. Citizens Climate Lobby, they say, this price on carbon is going to lower CO2 emissions by however much. We've got models that can prove it. So their vision of the future is that we just let the market decide. The market is not giving us a switch to renewables like we need. The market is giving us mostly gas and nuclear, which is not really a sustainable option and not where we want to be headed. Another one of the problems with the direction that we're headed is that even if we were to put really high prices on carbon, on emissions, the market is not likely to stop those activities because the government is propping this stuff up with massive subsidies. So the government is intervening to keep the fossil fuel industry not just operating, but profitable. And about 45% of all U.S. oil production is subsidized. 45%. We have a government that has proven over and over again it is willing to give handouts to industry in the form of subsidies and tax breaks, and will no doubt continue that practice and make any efforts that we have ineffective. It is the golden rule of all capitalist enterprises that you must make a profit for your shareholders. CEOs are required to prioritize profits for shareholders. In fact, if you were to have a fossil fuel CEO who decided to be responsible and maybe think about the future of humanity and stop their activities, they would no doubt quickly be removed by the shareholders because that CEO is not doing their legally required job anymore. All CEOs answer to shareholders and must prioritize profits. But what we need is often not profitable. In the case of clean energy, we can look at solar. You notice that in the market-based scenarios, we don't see a whole lot of solar in that mix, even though experts will tell us that this is a big part of the solution. And why is that? Because it's not profitable for the big companies. Because the way they're used to doing business is these big power plants with centrally produced power that produce massive amounts and distribute it to customers. But solar, what we're looking at is what's called distributed energy or small-scale distributed energy. So if we have homes that are equipped with solar panels and producing their own energy, those are people that the energy companies are no longer able to profit from. So it is not in the best interest of profit-seeking companies to roll out things like distributed community solar, even though that is very clearly one of the things that we need. And of course, what's profitable is often harmful, as in like our continued reliance on natural gas. Natural gas obviously continues to be very profitable for companies, but they continue doing it. Not only are they doing it, but they're investing in major new infrastructure that will be around for decades. They are locking us into decades more of fossil fuel use because it's making them money, and it's really that simple. But the other problem we face is that capitalism requires growth. I don't know how many of you have ever heard economists talk about economic plans, but they're very obsessed with GDP, which is gross domestic product. GDP is always supposed to be going up. That is how we measure progress in a capitalist system, is how much are we growing. The idea is that the rising tide lifts all boats, supposedly. So if we just produce more and more and more, eventually those things will make it to all the people. Because that's clearly not what's happening. This is also part of the trickle-down theory. We improve things for everybody and it gets spread around somehow. Without growth, we actually have a recession, and if it's bad enough, we call it a depression. And part of this is high unemployment rates. Because if growth stalls or even contracts, then companies scale back. They cut jobs. They replan for the future. They cancel those plans to expand that they might have had. They start shrinking their operations. People lose their jobs. It has a cascading effect throughout the whole economy. If it gets bad enough, business after business will go under, and we could end up in a downward spiral that is uncontrollable because we need growth. Capitalism depends on it. So if we stop growing, the system collapses. However, we have this problem where we're already over-consuming resources. We're using resources 50% faster than they can be replenished globally. The American lifestyle in particular is a very high consumption lifestyle. And people like to talk about raising the standard of living for people, but if we were to have everybody in the world living the American lifestyle, we would require 5.3 planet. Clearly not in the cards. To top it off, there is a class system to this as well. We've got the world's richest 10% produce 50% of carbon emissions. And the reverse is that the poorest fraction of the planet living very low consumptive lifestyles. So what we need to do is address the difference between the global north and the global south. Because it's not the global south that is causing these problems. It is us. It is us in the US and Europe, in the developed countries. And, you know, you kind of have to ask yourself, is it really progress if we have developed a lifestyle that is unsustainable? So yeah, resource limits. It turns out they're a thing. They exist. Economists don't like to acknowledge this. As a matter of fact, if you've learned, never taken an economics class, they teach you to just ignore the idea of resource limits. We can act as if they exist in infinite supply because there's always going to be a substitute, they think. You know, if something becomes scarce, the price will go up, will shift to something else. But there are a lot of resources that simply have no substitutes. And to top it off, this is a finite planet, and we will run out of things eventually. Yeah, it turns out this planet of ours has limits and boundaries, whether we like it or not. Beyond just climate change, we have biodiversity loss, major changes in land use, fresh water, ozone depletion, and the absorption of waste. Something that often doesn't come up when we're talking about climate change and other environmental problems is what we do with all of the waste and the things that we dump into the environment in various ways. There are limited capacities for the planet to absorb and deal with all of this stuff. So it is not just climate change that is our problem. And what happens when we ignore these limits? If we just keep plodding along as we have, the fact that we're using resources faster than they can be renewed is gonna hit us. And it's gonna hit us in the form of system collapse. So the choice we're basically faced with here is to do nothing and wait until the system collapses, which will be chaotic and bad for a lot of people, or we can have a managed decline. But that involves us intentionally coming together and making some decisions about how we make that happen. So when we talk about a managed decline, where we rein in our levels of production and consumption to sustainable rates, one step is obviously to cut unnecessary production. There is so much stuff that we produce that we simply don't need. Is it worth it for all of these things to be contributing to emissions, to contributing to resource depletion? This all comes at a cost. We need to start producing for human need and start focusing those resources that we have, taking the limited energy that will be available to us and focusing on the things we need, like obviously clean energy, public transportation. We need to take care of people's health. There are a lot of things that we do actually need, and we need to start shifting energy into those. Another piece of addressing climate change is to relocalize production. So right now we are essentially exporting a lot of our pollution to developing or undeveloped countries. So we get all this stuff by making it a lot of times in Asia, where there are lax environmental and worker protections. We produce all of the pollution over there, and then we ship it halfway around the world over here. And that shipping itself is actually a very large source of emissions, in addition to all of the trucks that then take the stuff from the ships and transport it all over the country. So one piece of the puzzle is to try and minimize that, to try and bring production back to the local as much as possible, rely on local resources, and in doing so, we have the opportunity to bring back some skilled jobs too. We should be making whatever we can as close to where we are as possible. We also need to restructure the food system because it's a big part of the problem. We need to move away from synthetic fertilizers because if nothing else, we will run out of them. Do things like diversify crops, because one of our big systemic risks right now is monoculture. The whole don't put all your eggs in one basket thing is a potentially big problem, because even though we are dumping all of these pesticides on crops, we are also creating things like super bugs in the process, and it is likely just a matter of time before we end up with a pest that just goes nuts on a particular crop, and if that's all we have in the Midwest, all one thing, that's a huge risk. Anything happens to that crop, there is not a backup. So part of restructuring our food system is to bring back diversity, to lower the risk of our food system collapsing in those ways, to repair and protect the soil which is a carbon thing, and again, to produce as much as possible locally. And we need to majorly rethink working jobs. And this is where it starts to really tie in with socialism. Because it's not just that we need to shift workers out of destructive industries and into building the stuff we need. We also need to produce less. If we're cutting back our production and consumption, that means we also should be able to work a lot less. Who doesn't want a world where we can work, I don't know, 20 hours a week and get by? Doesn't that sound great? Well, that's actually part of the climate solution. We need to reduce our waste and how much we are producing for the climate, and in doing so, can create a more enjoyable world for ourselves in the process. And part of that is to also cooperate instead of competing against one another. Because when we have companies competing against each other, we're not able to then make those big decisions that we need to. We really do need cooperation across different businesses, across different industries and sectors to be able to make the decisions that will keep us within these natural limits that we're facing. How do we decide what we need? Who gets to make those decisions? This is also a big piece of the puzzle, because it's not enough to just have worker co-ops. Worker co-ops are great, but the thing is, though, we can't stop there. Workers making decisions in the workplace only gets us so far. We also need to involve other stakeholders in those decisions. Like, who are we producing for? Have we determined if this is something we need? What are the potential consequences to the surrounding community of producing this, and open up decision making in such a way that we can democratically make these choices? Because at some point there will be trade-offs. We will have to decide that a certain amount of pollution or extraction is worth it because we just need certain things. We're not realistically going to get to a point where we stop all industrial activity, and that's not something that I'm suggesting, but we do need to limit it to what we need. But in order to determine what people need, we actually need to involve people in making those decisions. So, you know, one possibility is not just for workers or producers' councils, but consumer councils, or to involve impacted communities in some way. Who needs to be involved? Who's going to be impacted? You hear in the climate movement a lot of talk of a just transition. And the just transition refers to not just our switching from fossil fuels to renewable energy. It's the just part is the justice, it is the social justice, and it is the piece that is required to fundamentally transform our economy. So in order to get closer to that just transition, some things that I mentioned, we need more inclusive decision-making structures. And especially as socialists, this is something that we need to start thinking about. What is our vision for the future? What does the system look like that we're proposing as an alternative? How are we going to change who is making decisions and transition away from having CEOs making decisions for the sake of profit to people and communities coming together to produce for human need? We also need to make sure that we're basing those decisions on natural limits, because regardless of what we might want, we need to keep our activity within those limits, which means when we're envisioning our system, how is that going to work? How are we going to identify those limits and then bring people together to decide how to fit our activity within it? The only fair way to do this is to involve people, to make it a democratic process. We need to chip away at corporate power. So instead of these market-based mechanisms, one step we could take is to push for direct regulation. Maybe even public takeovers of industry. We need to start thinking about how we actually remove the decision-making power and the power in general from corporations and shift it back to the people. Something we can also do in terms of policies, if we're looking at where to start with this, is to remove legal barriers to collective organizing and the things we need to do. Because there are actually a lot of obstacles preventing us from doing what we need to do because the corporate structure is ingrained in our system. And of course, part of the just transition is to redistribute wealth and resources. We're talking about taking away corporate power, evening the playing field, redistributing resources, making decisions fairly and inclusively. So this is the vision that we need to keep in mind, and we absolutely need to be going after the fossil fuel industry and throwing ourselves ourselves at the gears of the system like we've been doing to stop the expansion, but we can't forget about the future that we want and what that looks like and what we need to do to build it.
Thanks to Katie Barrett for that talk. You can find that session, as well as many others from the DSA, Portland DSA Summer Day School, at soundcloud.com, Portland DSA. And also, of course, socialism is hot in America. It's not a trend. It's for real. And you can find more information on local struggles, like campaigns to tax the rich, Medicare for all, efforts to abolish ICE, and make Portland a real sanctuary city, by going to portlanddsa.org. Monthly meetings are open and new members are always welcome. A growing and wonderful movement in our city. Next up, though, we've got Larry Bolden, our book mole, here with another book review.
Good morning. I'm going to talk to you today about a book that so irritated me as I was reading it that I almost stopped several times, and I did put it aside for a couple of days while I read another book. It is a 2018 novel by Elizabeth Cohen, The Glitch, and upon completion, I think it's one of the funniest books I've read all year. Shelley Stone is the CEO of a very successful company called Conch, and I can say that she's one of the least likable characters I've ever met. The Conch is a very small device that fits just behind the ear and is in fact a high-power computer that can do a multitude of tasks. Shelley says of herself that stress is the airstream in which she flies. She has a husband and two children, but they are laughably incidental to her real life, which is work. In an early passage of the book where Shelley is with Rafa, her husband, in a restaurant, a rose in a vase has the audacity to sag to one side. She tries to adjust it, but it doesn't work. Quote, I tried to pretend it didn't bother me, but I could tell he knew it annoyed me. That's one of the problems of marriage, the ability to read the truth off each other's faces. It obviates all the effort you make to hide how you really feel. Close quote. Shelley is only happy when she's at work, but she takes the entire search for happiness to be misguided. Quoting again, Raphael is a bit pleasure-driven. Pleasure doesn't hold the same pleasure for me. I get bored and irritable. It takes so long. An appetizer's enough for me to feel I've had the experience at the restaurant, and lying down for 5 minutes is enough of a nap, and I like to schedule sex for when we're changing our clothes anyway. Then I need to get back to work. Pleasure's not something I have much time for. The pointlessness of it, the inefficiency and excess, close quote. While in Barcelona to give an inspirational speech to a group of successful women, her Conch seems to exhibit a glitch. For one thing, it identifies a young woman who is approaching her as herself, Shelley Stone, and this initiates a wonderfully absurd sequence of events as she tries to determine if the young woman is, in fact, a younger version of herself. Another client is told by his Conch to jump off a cliff, and he does as told. Just as they're about to launch a new model, they have to try to deal with this glitch. That part of the story is complicated and in most ways tangential to the main theme of the novel, which I take to be the incredibly high price women have to pay to enter into the highest power positions in corporations. But while that is, I believe, the serious undercurrent of the novel, it is the wildly funny descriptions of the monomania of Shelley that keep the reader's interest. Rather than trying to paraphrase some of these sections, I think I'll quote some passages that will do a better job of conveying the humor. An interviewer asked Shelley, Wow, so you get up at 3:30 every morning? It's true, you have to be disciplined to lead this kind of life. Discipline is so important. I'm a grateful hostage to my routines and my checklists. But the truth is, and I'm going to give it to you straight, that when anxiety is ripping our insides to pieces, it is actually a lot easier to get out of bed than to lie there wanting to die. I can't sleep. It's not that I don't want to, but I need the time, so it all works out. Anxiety has replaced caffeine for me. I'm always asking myself, how can I fit in a little more work? What else can go? So there's more time to work. just because it's 4:30 or 5 a.m. our time doesn't mean things aren't really rocking in the Melee production facility. So I check with some of our vendors and retailers. Making that time count allows me to squeeze in a shower, because it's important to take time for yourself. While I'm in the shower, I brainstorm solutions to work problems. Then I get out. I have towels I get from a special place in London, extra soaky. I have a system for drying myself in a quarter of the time. What's your secret to balancing it all? She says, if I had to laser in on my most key pieces of advice, I would say surround yourself with good help. Pick a good spouse, parenthetically, which is basically the same thing. Offload everything that is not core and don't lose minutes. Close quote. Shelley thinks of herself as a good and capable mother, but reading some of her parenting ideas will surely convince readers otherwise. Quoting again, every day I feel such a pride and purpose as I walk into Conch. If I'm not at work, I'm thinking about work. So it's satisfying when my mind and surroundings sink. Close quote. Shelley's Q score, which measures likability, tops out in the single digits. But she wonders why she's not more likable. She likes herself. Quote, still, a more likable CEO might help Conch at the margins, and I felt I had in me the potential, even obligation, to become an averagely likable person. Close quote. The reader discovers that Shelley was struck by lightning as a teenager, and while suffering through a long and painful recovery, she reckons that the strike made her into the successful overachiever she needs to be to run this large corporation. Quoting once more from the book, I happen to love Mondays. They are the most productive day and my favorite. Thank God it's Monday, I always think when I wake up. It's not that I dread the weekends per se. I love them differently, like a second child. On Saturday mornings, I feel, despite my efforts, a little down at the prospect of temporarily unplugging. And although I never really do entirely, there's something depressing about pinging out emails and knowing it could be an hour or more before anyone replies. The work week at Conch is a joy, so it's a nice feeling to have as much of it as possible still to come. Close quote. From reading the acknowledgments at the end of the book, it is obvious Cohen has done her homework, Ray, women in high power positions and the toll it takes. And I have to admit, once I realized that she's intentionally caricaturing life of a successful CEO, I found the humor of the book more compelling. Shelley says she prioritizes Conch and her children, and wonders if perhaps she should have prioritized her marriage more. She says, but how many things can be a priority? Really, just one at a time. Priority is not a word that legitimately be pluralized. And Rafa understands, or I thought he did. He has his own work. All of them. Conch, her assistant Cullen, kids, Rafa. He needs me the least. You'll have to read the book to discover more about the glitch and about the juggling act of Shelley. I've been talking about Elizabeth Cohen's novel, The Glitch. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry, and thanks to our guests this morning. We are, of course, a collective, a radio collective, and it takes a collective labor to bring you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. And I want to thank everyone for their participation this morning, and tune in next Monday. We'll post this program on kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour later this week.